Okay, so welcome back, and we're hoping that you had a very interactive set of breakout sessions and had an opportunity to get some of your more practical and specific questions addressed, and that perhaps that has primed some even deeper questions for this closing panel. And we're calling this Where the Rubber Meets the Road, Implementing Health Reform Within AHRQ, HRSA, and CDC ATSDR. Not a very dynamic title. I actually think of this group as the A-team of healthcare reform implementation. And I think you'll agree with me after you hear their comments and have an opportunity to probe their thinking on what are the real opportunities from their agency perspectives as to how to make this healthcare reform implementation stick, particularly in the areas of public health practice that we've all been longing to delve into for many years and are now experiencing our first real opportunity to try to apply it. So, I'm going to introduce all three of the speakers, and then they're going to come up and make about 5 minutes of comments, and then we have some questions for them, and then we're going to turn it open to you to question them. And we'll see how that goes. First, Dr. Elena Arias serves as the Principal Deputy Director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and Agency for Toxic Substance and Disease Registry. Prior to appointment, Dr. Arias was the director of the National Center for Injury Prevention and Control at CDC, where she worked to prevent injuries and violence and reduce their consequences. Dr. Carolyn M. Clancy was appointed director of the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, AHRQ, on February 5th, 2003. Is that right? Wow. Prior to appointment, Dr. Clancy was director of AHRQ's Center for Outcomes and Effectiveness Research. Her major research interests include improving healthcare quality and patient safety and reducing disparities in care associated with patients' race, ethnicity, gender, income, and education. And Dr. Mary Wakefield is the administrator of the Health Resources and Services Administration. I'm hearing some squeaking here. I don't know what that is. Dr. Wakefield joined HRSA from the University of North Dakota, UND, where she was Associate Dean for Rural Health at the School of Medicine and Health Sciences, a tenured professor and director of the University Center for Rural Health. So without any further ado, we're going to go right into it with Dr. Arias.
Thank you. Good afternoon. It's a pleasure to join you today at this summit on healthcare reform to discuss the implications that the Affordable Care Act has and will have on public health. I thank you for inviting me to share my thoughts on healthcare reform and especially to share information on the efforts that are underway at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to ensure the successful implementation of the Act. Public health agencies, I think we've all recognized, have an incredibly large role to play in the success of healthcare reform, especially as the interaction between clinical and community health becomes larger. The Affordable Care Act is a real opportunity for public health. As the nation's premier public health agency, we're poised to leverage our resources, enhance our partnerships, and implement sustainable and evidence-based interventions to reduce the burden of disease across the country. The Act recognizes how important public health is, as evidenced by the funding that has been authorized to support a myriad of issues, including HIV prevention, public health infrastructure, healthcare surveillance, and workforce development. The investments that the Act makes in public health workforce will benefit our communities for decades to come. The Department of Health and Human Services is working with state and local partners and dispersing billions of dollars in grant assistance to ensure that Americans get the care that they need under the Act. CDC has undertaken organizational improvement efforts that position us to take an active and integral role in health reform. Our organizational structure is supportive of the changes that need to take place and the work that needs to be done to ensure that we get health reform right. Our new organization is better aligned to CDC public health priorities and to our five strategic directives, namely to strengthen surveillance, epidemiology, and laboratory services, to strengthen ability to support state, tribal, local, and territorial public health, to provide leadership in public health, to provide leadership in health policies, including health reform, and to provide leadership to better address the leading causes of death and disability. Since the passage of the Affordable Care Act on March 23rd of this year, the agency has been involved in several initiatives related to implementation. We're participating actively and widely in a number of work groups and councils that have been established for the act that address major categories of work. So for example, we co-lead the prevention work group and several work groups planning implementation of initiatives and activities such as the community transformation grants, the Guide to Community Preventive Services Task Force, and young women's breast cancer awareness. We co-lead and work on the workforce development work group, developing plans to expand the skills and the numbers of public health workers. We participate on the Maternal and Child Health Working Group addressing CDC input in issues such as teen pregnancy prevention and home visitation services. We participate in the Quality of Care Work Group with the goal of initiating more attention to prevention and public health opportunities throughout the healthcare system. We also co-lead the development of the National Prevention Strategy, which you've heard about earlier today, which will create a blueprint for prevention and health promotion strategy to be incorporated at all levels of federal government activities. And finally, but not least in importance, we are heavily involved in the measurement and evaluation working groups developing easy to understand dashboards that will track agreed upon indicators to be used in monitoring progress. We've initiated activities surrounding the allocation of the Prevention and Public Health Fund. Specifically, we have planned for the distribution of $191 million in CDC programs in FY 2010. Examples include epidemiology and laboratory capacity grants to states, HIV prevention activities, including increased testing and the support of novel interventions, tobacco use reduction activities, and support for the public health infrastructure through performance improvement. We've developed a strategy and spending plans for FY 2011 and 2012 that steadily increased the stream of prevention and public health fund dollars that are specifically targeted to public health programs. We have increased collaboration and coordination among programs within CDC and partnered with other departmental agencies that are working on their own programs. Examples of those include partnering with CMS on a variety of activities, but specifically working with them to incorporate a health risk appraisal as part of a wellness visit for Medicare clients. We're providing public health insight to supplement planning for primary care workforce and statewide insurance exchanges, and developing a strategy for CDC to envision public health in the context of health reform and to help state and local programs plan for anticipated changes. We are finally planning for short, mid, and long-term measurement of success, including operational measures, of course, such as execution of funded activities, but also measures of outcome that track the impact of the Affordable Care Act on the nation's health. We look forward to continuing our work with other agencies, other federal agencies, the private sector, and the public health community at large to set a course for healthcare reform implementation, to improve public health impact, and to take advantage of opportunities for health improvement. Again, I thank you deeply for the opportunity to present today at the summit, and I look forward to continued discussion on the implementation and impact of the Affordable Care Act. Thank you.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. I really want to pay tribute to the enthusiasm of everyone in this room who stayed inside on such a really gorgeous, gorgeous day. For those of you who aren't familiar with ARC, we are, I guess, the newest public health service agency, about 20 years old, really created in response to growing evidence about substantial variations in practice, which was eventually communicated effectively to members of Congress as multiple sources of cost without benefit. Today, you can click on the Dartmouth Atlas online and look at all those pretty maps. Back then, we didn't have that. We didn't have the internet, right, until Al Gore invented it. So, but still, the people who did the work were actually able to convey the importance of it, and so we've been in business since late 1989. I wanted to start just for a moment to reflect on some of the huge public health successes of the 20th century. Declines, for example, in coronary heart disease, death, and stroke, resulting from risk factor modifications such as smoking cessation and blood pressure control, have meant that since 1952, death rates from coronary disease alone have decreased by 51%. Since the 1900s, better hygiene and nutrition, the availability of antibiotics, better access to care, and technological advances in maternal and neonatal medicine have led to a 90% decrease in infant mortality and a 99% decrease in maternal mortality. I do not want to suggest that we're done in either area, and we have growing challenges now, particularly attributable to chronic diseases. But at the same time, I think it's important to recognize that those big advances in public health are a tribute to strong partnerships between care delivery and public health, a theme that I think has to resonate throughout implementation of the Affordable Care Act. So our mission at ARC is to improve the safety, quality, and efficiency and effectiveness of health care. But we can't do that unless we're working very strongly with our public health colleagues. Now, recent legislation gives us the resources to support the level of transformation that's necessary to go about the practice of preventing disease and promoting health on a much, much larger scale. And before you even get to the Affordable Care Act, I think it's important to recognize the Recovery Act, because the investments in health IT, in comparative effectiveness research, or what we're now calling patient-centered outcomes research because it sounds less scary, and prevention, I think represented a very strong down payment on the scientific infrastructure that we're going to need to make this incredible opportunity sustainable. So the $1.1 billion for patient-centered outcomes research was funding for more rapid identification and implementation of patient-centered outcomes research in clinical practice, shared decision-making, care delivery, and in evaluating evidence for community-based practices in public health. Some of the activities pursued with this funding will include design and implementation of community-based programs to achieve public health goals. Let me just give you an example of one project that is really cool here in Denver. So at Denver Health, they are using text messaging to help elderly Hispanics improve control of their diabetes. Now, we know that only 9% of adults with diabetes have only diabetes, so you know these patients have other chronic illnesses as well. And when asked, do you have a cell phone, 50% of the patients, most of whom don't speak English, said yes. The vast majority of the rest said, you know what? I don't have a cell phone, but I have a grandson or somebody who can help me with this. And the response has been fantastic. So the clinicians can actually begin to send them messages to remind the patients to monitor how they're doing and so forth. The patients text back how they're doing, and it's uploaded to their health record. It doesn't get better than this. Now, at Denver Health, they've got the incentive to do the best possible job because they are struggling mightily against scarce resources. There's absolutely no reason we can't do that in communities across this country. So fully a quarter of the resources went to support investments in data infrastructure. Now, that data infrastructure is for research. It can also be used for operations to improve quality of care. And ultimately, I see that as a part of the bridge between care delivery and public health for improving population public health overall. Some other investments that came about in recent legislation include investments in quality measures for children in the CHIP Reauthorization Act. For a whole variety of reasons I won't bore you with, they've been a little bit left behind in recent advances in assessing and improving quality of care. So both the Federal Coordinating Council last year and the Institute of Medicine Committee on Comparative Effectiveness Research said that comparative effectiveness research has to be more than about the what we're doing clinically. It has to include, quote unquote, care delivery interventions. I put that in quotes because we don't even know how to define that. We don't even have a really good vocabulary, right? We know what 20 milligrams of Lipitor is. We don't always know if people are taking it, but we know what it is. It has a standard meaning. We can't say that for interventions to improve population health. So shifting gears to the Affordable Care Act, I know you heard from my fabulous colleagues this morning, Drs. Koh and Benjamin, what a strong focus there is on prevention, and you heard about that from Dr. Arias as well. A little known secret is that there's a number of strong themes in this bill that really resonate with the idea of evidence-based policy. So for example, all of those preventive services, as you've heard, derive from evidence-based recommendations from the Preventive Services Task Force, from the ACIP, sponsored by CDC, and so forth. And there's a huge array of provisions to assess and improve quality of care. Now, the front end of the bill tells CMS to keep doing everything they're doing right now on quality, but do more of it faster. There you go. I just covered 20% of the 2,700 pages for you. They're very long sections. Later in the bill, there's language and significant resources for a Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. Now, there's an idea. How do we do a better job providing care through new models of care, new models of payment, very importantly, all of which I think, again, are going to require strong partnerships between clinical care and public health, and I hear that out of Don Berwick about every other sentence. And comparative effectiveness research will be supported by a new institute, the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute. The board has been appointed. I can't tell you much more than that because there isn't a lot more to report just at this moment. Now, in the middle of all this, there is something called the National Strategy for Quality. How many of you have ever looked at a website to find out about quality of care? Okay, keep your hands up if you found useful information. Okay, a lot of hands just went down. One of my former colleagues at CMS used to say that all of the quality activities we were pursuing, you know, collectively, reminded him of six-year-olds playing soccer. And if you think about it, confusion about who's on the team and which goal we're going for, I think he had something there. I'm taking it as an optimistic metaphor, though, because the best thing about six-year-olds playing soccer, besides passion and energy, is they all get better. And hopefully we can do that in quality as well. The strategy is clearly intended to integrate and align the many federal and private sector efforts that are underway or being initiated to a coherent plan of action. In other words, to shift the focus on collaboration and competition, not from which measure we're going to use, but how do we get better faster, like those six-year-olds playing soccer. Because we believe this has to be a shared responsibility between the feds and the states and between the government and the private sector, we actually posted a framework for public comment and got a huge array of responses back. So if any of you were part of that, let me thank you here. The framework simply speaks to three core ideas. The first is better care. No matter where you land for care, you should know that the default option is the best quality possible. And that includes integration of behavioral and mental health into the healthcare sector. The second pillar is affordable care. To say our healthcare system costs are out of control, I think, is stating the obvious. I will simply leave it at that. Now, it's really easy to cut costs. You just move decimal points, strike out a few zeros, you can go home early, right? Doing it without hurting people, that actually takes more work. I would also point you to Denver Health as a really superb example of what's achievable. There's no reason the private sector can't catch up to this fantastic public system. And the third is, and this may strike you as interesting, healthy people and healthy communities. If we don't begin to work together now to address the upstream causes of illness and disease, we are never going to be able to bail our way out of this overloaded boat, if you will. So this is going to demand new kinds of partnerships between care delivery and public health. I think the Recovery Act investments in infrastructure set the stage for these kinds of partnerships, as well as for thinking about how do we use research infrastructure for the operational infrastructure we need to make those changes and improvements sustainable. And I also want to emphasize that from the get-go, we are very attentive to the need for close synergy between the National Prevention Strategy and the National Quality Strategy. So the bottom line here is that we need to start yesterday on creating the 21st century success stories, and the most exciting thing is we get to do it. So we look forward to working with you.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you this afternoon. What I'd like to do is just give you a quick overview of some of the areas of focus of the Health Resources and Services Administration, because my guess is it is not quite as familiar to you as perhaps ARC is or the CDC. And then I want to spend the last couple of minutes talking with you about some of the Affordable Care Act provisions that are of direct or indirect relevance to you and to APHA and to others that care deeply about, of course, the nation's public health. Just then, for starters, HRSA. HRSA is about a $7.5 billion agency that has a portfolio of different programs, most of which are designed to address the healthcare needs of vulnerable populations. Those populations might be medically vulnerable, geographically vulnerable, financially vulnerable. And I'll give you just a few examples of some of the programs that we operate. And then, as I mentioned, I want to jump right into some of those Affordable Care Act provisions that HRSA has responsibility for implementing. So HRSA's portfolio of programs constitutes about 80 different programs that flow through a number of different bureaus and offices. Across those bureaus, you see, for example, the implementation of the Community Health Centers program. We have about 1,100 community health centers that we put funds into across the United States. And they operate delivering primary care and preventive care at over 7,600 sites across the nation. And through those community health centers, they serve about 19 million patients. Just as an aside, think about the data set there. We actually do collect uniform data across the patient population served through community health centers. HRSA also administers the Ryan White HIV/AIDS program. It was reauthorized last year. It was not included as a program in the Affordable Care Act. But through the Ryan White program, we deliver health care services to about 500,000 low-income and uninsured people across the country living with HIV and AIDS. We also operate the Maternal Child Health Block Grant that provides services, counseling, health care to about 6 out of every 10 women that give birth in the United States, so pretty significant reach through the MCH program. And we have some of the major workforce programs in terms of primary care, dentistry, nursing, and others. We house the department's Office of Rural Health Policy, which helps to sustain and strengthen rural healthcare infrastructure. We have particular programs that touch telehealth, primarily in rural areas, but not just. And we also oversee the nation's programs that deal with organ transplant and donation, the poison control centers we put resources into, and the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. So that gives you just a quick thumbnail sketch of some of the major programs that are operated through the Health Resources and Services Administration. Everything that we do across that set of programs that I just mentioned to you, we do almost all of it in partnership with local entities, grantees, a state government, and regional organizations. There is almost nothing that is done at HRSA, except that it is done through collaboration with coalitions of healthcare providers, health associations, and so on. We have recently been involved in not just implementing our traditional set of programs, but also about $2.5 billion of Recovery Act funds, some of which we're still finishing the rollout on, almost all of which, though, of that $2.5 billion has already flowed to the field to support healthcare workers workforce development as well as our community health centers. And now, of course, we have the Affordable Care Act that we're in the midst of engaging a number of provisions. In terms of HRSA, we have, like CDC, have actually realigned some of our major parts of our organization for different reasons, but also inclusive of now deploying new initiatives through and expanded initiatives through the Affordable Care Act. So, for example, our 10 regional offices that are close to many of you across the country have been redesigned largely to be able to do a better job of deploying Affordable Care Act initiatives. Through the Affordable Care Act, HRSA has the lead in for implementing about 50 different provisions of this bill, of this legislation now, and, well, of this law. And we co-share a lead responsibility for about another 16 provisions. I'm going to share with you just about five areas of focus. So I'm not going to go into all 50, just share about five areas of focus where we're now in the process of implementing a lot of effort, some key areas that touch on healthcare infrastructure, inclusive of the healthcare workforce, and some of the provisions that deal specifically with special populations. So let me just share with you those quickly those five areas. First of all, and the largest investment financially by a long shot, is the $11 billion that is being deployed over this year, fiscal year 2011, through 2015, targeting community health centers. So $11 billion that we will be expending over the next 5 years to expand the health center network. That's to establish new starts. So in other words, new sites, new locations. It is to engage in construction and renovation, and also to expand services, to support, for example, more oral health services, more behavioral health services, vision, and other services. We announced last month our first major Affordable Care Act investment in health centers under the Affordable Care Act, about $730 million that we deployed to upgrade and expand community health centers. In addition, we've also announced calls for applications for new starts, and you'll continue to see more of those resources rolling out over the course of even the next few months in terms of calls for proposals. In addition to that infrastructure that's broad in terms of its focus, that is community health centers, we also have resources through the ACA that we're deploying to extend health care to specific populations. In this case, school-based health centers. So we have a specific line of funding now available to strengthen school-based health centers to support primary health care services to children, to school-age children. Those funds are available, for example, for construction, renovation, equipment, and we expect to award about $100 million in about 200 different grants in fiscal year 2011. Those awards will be announced in the first half of next year, that is, the recipients of those awards will be announced. The application call for proposals is already on the street, and the deadline for submission of those applications is December 1st. There are a number of different categories that of sponsors that can apply for that funding: public health departments, hospitals, schools, community health centers, tribal entities, and so on. So again, part of the community health center or health center family, beginning to build and push out more broadly access to primary care services for adults and families and so on in the health centers, and then specifically for children in those school-based health center programs. We also have, this is the first area of focus. The second area of focus is on workforce. And so you see the Affordable Care Act coming in on the heels of the Recovery Act, so the stimulus funds, really beginning to put more planks into the workforce platform. In terms of HRSA's programs, we saw changes, large and small, in many, many of our healthcare workforce programs, primary care programs, in medicine, as I mentioned, dentistry, nursing, and others. And so on this front, probably one of the best known programs is the National Health Service Corps, which is really a distribution program. It helps to place healthcare providers, primary care providers, in underserved rural and urban areas across the United States. That program, for those of you that might be familiar with it, has been anemically funded for years. And we have scores and scores, actually hundreds, of health profession shortage areas that have been designated across the United States that are shy of healthcare providers. So this is a really wonderful, and I would say just-in-time infusion of resources to provide scholarship and loan repayment for primary care clinicians to the tune of about $1.5 billion over this 5 years. So for any schools that are preparing the next generation of healthcare providers, here's the opportunity. And this is not a program that is being deployed going forward the way it has been deployed even in the most recent years. There is a lot of innovation we're driving into that program so that I think you'll find that it would, for those of you familiar with it, you would find it to look quite different than it has historically. In addition to that redistribution, as I mentioned, we've also seen a lot of changes in our workforce programs elsewhere. And it's probably worth noting that just in about a month or two ago, the Secretary announced $250 million made available through the Affordable Care Act, again on the primary care side, primarily on the primary care side, to ramp up more primary care clinicians, including primary care physicians, so funding into residency programs to create new slots, not the current slots, so new slots, primary care nurse practitioners, primary care physician assistants, and so on. So as I said, lots of investments then in the primary care workforce. In addition, some investments in healthcare workforce tracking and also in specifically in public health workforce. In addition to the nearly $3.8 million that HRSA invested in public health training programs last year under the Recovery Act, so under the stimulus legislation, $7 million more was committed this year. And those funds support public health students, public health dentistry, preventive medicine, and so on, all students in training. In September, in addition to that, Secretary Sebelius announced $16.8 million to expand the number of HRSA-sponsored public health training centers to 33 public health training centers, and most of that funding was made available through the Affordable Care Act. Institutions, of course, that are accredited to provide graduate or specialized public health training use those funds to enhance the skill sets of current and future public health workforce. Also included was about $6 million that went directly to states to help them in their planning around healthcare workforce, tailoring efforts to needs that exist locally. Finally, in the area of workforce, the Act also established a National Center for Healthcare Workforce Analysis, which will provide modeling and data in order to project current and future workforce trends. Right now, this center is working closely with CDC and the Public Health Foundation to develop methods to track the distribution and supply of the public health workforce, working specifically on a public health enumeration study. So those are Affordable Care Act investments, coupled with Recovery Act investments, that bring resources that that help to counter years of what I would suggest has been underinvestment in our healthcare workforce. Moving beyond that, just that area of healthcare workforce, just a couple of other areas that you might be interested in. This is not funded through the Affordable Care Act, but you might be interested to know that HRSA and CDC have just recently partnered with IOM to pursue a study that will focus on the alignment of primary care and public health. So a two-year study that we're asking the IOM to do, to carry out, that will really drill down not on those areas separately, but rather on the nexus of primary care and public health. It's extremely important, I think, especially from my vantage point as the administrator of HRSA, because so much of our programs, while deploying primary care services, are really deploy those resources against the backdrop of population and of population health. This focus on public health for HRSA is the reason why shortly after I took my position, eliminated the chief public health officer position at HRSA and instead introduced the chief public health, eliminated the chief medical officer position and created a chief public health officer position that is filled by Dr. Q. Ree, who is here today. I also we have also at HRSA created a public health task force that runs and is looking to thread a stronger public health focus through our various programs. And you see public health reflected in our strategic plan for this agency. Again, thinking that the primary care delivery through the vehicles that we have, the portfolio of programs that we operate, from my vantage point, should not be implemented separate and apart from a public health context. Last couple of areas just to mention quickly, HRSA has been very much involved in strengthening the healthy weight focus, that is both the First Lady's focus and a primary focus for Secretary Sebelius. So we right now have a healthy weight initiative that was funded through the Public Health and the Prevention and Public Health Fund of the Affordable Care Act. We've just launched that, awarded that grant, a $5 million grant that pivots off of a much larger focus for HHS going forward. We're in the process of identifying and through this initiative, interventions that community teams will be testing. It's very much an evidence-based approach to engaging both clinical and community-based stakeholders in focusing on both prevention and treatment of obesity, particularly in children and families. And we're certainly working with a range of different organizations on that implementation, ASHTO, NACHO, and other organizations, foundations, and so on. Finally, we also have the last program that I'll mention, which is a program that's being deployed through our Maternal Child Health Bureau. The Affordable Care Act commits about $100 million in 2010, fiscal year 2010, for a new home visiting program. This home visiting program is designed to improve the health outcomes of children and families that reside in high-risk communities. This, Carolyn mentioned that I find this refreshing as a former academician, that it's not uncommon to find provisions in the Affordable Care Act that pivot off of an evidence base. I mentioned one to you just a minute ago, our Healthy Weight Initiative, and now this is a second one that I think is worth pointing out, and that is that the models that our home visiting programs that the states will be deploying must be evidence-based. So over the next few years, you're seeing a $1.5 billion authorization that underlies the home visiting program would be deployed over the next 4 years, with, as I mentioned, that $100 million investment starting right now. So with that, it's just a brief overview of some of the activities that are underway at the Health Resources and Services Administration related to the Affordable Care Act implementation. Clearly, I'll end where I began, which is that much of what we're doing, not just with the ACA, but with the rest of our programs, we do in partnership. And I'm really pleased to say we have a very strong partnership and working relationship with the APHA. It's a very, very important partner for HRSA, for across all of the programs that I just mentioned and others that I don't have time to mention. So when given the opportunity to come and speak with you today, I've very much appreciated it. You are, I think, one of our most important partners as we continue to push this agenda forward. Thank you very much.
Okay. It works. Good. So now we're going to actually ask the panel some questions, probably fewer questions than I originally intended, so that we can get to the audience. So start thinking about your questions. We have about 22 minutes or so for the remainder of this session. And the first question I want to ask is that, given the fact that, you know, you're in a room full of public health practitioners, people who are struggling to imagine what the 21st century public health practice looks like, that tackles these challenges of health inequities, the challenges of chronic disease prevention at the community level. And we're sort of trying to imagine what that all looks like. We know that it involves the intersection of primary care and community practice. We know that it involves interdisciplinary practice looking at the determinants of health, transportation, housing, et cetera. We know that it involves practices that are more participatory, that community residents are more engaged in helping to shape the conditions in their communities. So you all grew up somewhere. And so what I want you to do is to just think back to where you grew up and think about what the 21st century public health practice should look like
as incentivized by the Affordable Care Act, and what your agency can do to advance that practice. And we can pick a topic, pick something like obesity prevention to make it focused.
Sure, I'll go ahead and get started and then talk about it a little bit more generally. Maybe others may want to get a little specific with just, you know, specific issues. I think, in personally, and for CDC, and they coincide, which is good for me. One of the things that I think we have a vision for is making sure that we create an environment that essentially almost guarantees access to prevention and health services so that health is promoted and protected. And there are three major ways that I think we have to, things that we have to do now. We have Affordable Care Act, some things are about that, changes that we're making at CDC are about that. Three primary things that would help us create that context in order to increase that kind of access for care. The first is that we have to provide, we have to improve the infrastructure that's available at all levels to make sure that the services that are necessary are going to actually be delivered and that people are going to have access to those services. We're trying to come up with synonyms when we're in infrastructure since that usually scares people away. But essentially what we're talking about is just enabling the organizations, both governmental and non-governmental, who are in a position to actually protect the mental health of citizens. Related to that is making sure that we are supporting, and we've done this within public health. I think that as a society, we actually have provided this. Certainly, it was not true, it may not even be true in areas that I grew up in, and we wish that in 10 years from now it were true. And that is that we're supporting the implementation of evidence-based interventions and strategies, things that not only do we know are going to make a difference, that is, are going to work, but that are going to make a difference at a population level, that really are there to drive down costs and improve health in a way that we've never seen health improve in this country before. And then lastly, from sort of CDC, it shouldn't be surprising, what I would then also like to see is a true commitment to data, not only in terms of identifying what's effective through research and other means, but also to take the care to monitor and evaluate what's being done, what services are being provided, what the impact of those services are, both on health and on cost, and doing that in an integral way, in a way that we have not done to date.
Thank you. Dr. Clancy.
Well, thank you for this question. I grew up in Massachusetts, and therefore the University of Massachusetts, very strong public health. You know, I think it's easy to think that public health is being upended and clinical care is just still the same and is still overspending and sucking in all that, all those resources. In fact, clinical care is kind of being upended as well. Anyone who's had clinical training, right, it's all based on the hospital, which means we're in charge. You go somewhere when we tell you to, and so on and so forth. Well, you know, that's all been transitioning for decades, actually, to where more and more care is outpatient. And in fact, these days, more and more care is at home. So I think the theme is going to be one of blurred boundaries, just as it is, or blurred boundaries may be too threatening a way to put it. It's much more about shared opportunities and shared accountability for getting it right. And I think what makes it so hard to envision right now is it feels like everyone has to start from scratch and reinvent it and so forth. So one resource I wanted to make people aware of is we have a website which is intended to be a home, if you will, for folks who want to share their innovations and how to improve. And that includes everything from, you know, very specific clinical interventions to community health workers working together to figure out how we're going to address the needs of the most vulnerable individuals in our community. As someone told me a year ago, yeah, we're all health reform, it doesn't actually matter. Our people are not going to be like in big demand at all. So it's just innovations.arc.gov, check it out. In terms of obesity, the struggle that clinicians have is the good thing they have is the teachable moment. The moment when someone's worried about a particular problem, whether it's a notice from school or something that the child, for example, can no longer do. That's a really powerful moment to have. At the same time, where clinicians are completely blind, there's no one where to plug individuals, families, caregivers, and so forth in the community. And these partnerships exist, but I think they could be much more effective. And I'll just leave you with one positive example. As a result of Arab investments and investments from ARC, because Congress gave us resources to focus on the how of eliminating healthcare-associated infections, on the ground, our folks focused on reducing and eliminating serious bloodstream infections from centralized for people in ICUs, are working hand-in-hand with CDC-funded investments at departments of public health. That, I think, is the model for the future, and there's no reason we can't do it.
Thank you.
So I mentioned just a couple of comments. First of all, I'd say I'm from a community that many of you have probably personally visited. That would be Adolph Lake, North Dakota. and so how would I see that differently? Well, one thing I see a lot fewer, a few years off, one thing I would see a lot fewer high-paying buffets. That would probably be a good thing. More seriously, some of what I would love to envision would be closing of a gap in terms of health status between the community that resides inside that town and a community that resides barely 20 miles away from it. One is American Indian and one is a white population. And you might as well have those two communities on two different planets in terms of how well we do just 12 miles away, maybe 12,000 miles away, with regard to some of the healthcare challenges impacting particularly that tribal community. So if I were to envision it differently, I would envision those disparities being absolutely gone, not decreased, but gone. But, we're working very, very closely with the Indian Health Service through HRSA. My view is that one of the vulnerable populations in the United States are those populations that reside on our in urban areas as well, but on reservations across the country, including in my home state. And so, while historically IHS has been viewed as the go-to place for all resources, as many of you have noticed, they've been a little bit shy of that for funding over the last number of years. And so we're really trying to plow our resources more broadly to make them available too, viewing their population and our population for HRSA's program. So that's a new direction that we've been pushing forward on. And we're doing that very much through our Affordable Care Act investments in a lot of new ways. So I think we're going to see things differently in terms of workforce, access to National Health Service Corps clinicians, better bridging with our community health centers going forward, and so on. So elimination of disparities, just a couple of other comments. And that's a small community out front. It's about 7,400 people, give or take, mostly elderly. So it isn't Boston, and it doesn't have the access, maybe that's a good thing, I don't know, it doesn't have access to the same resources. But it does mean that the way healthcare is deployed really does need to be different there. And so it's all about capitalizing on investments that we have in telehealth technology that I don't think we have begun to harness or harvest. Both the connectivity to individuals and families, as well as the connectivity to healthcare providers. So some of that's there already. There are seeds of it across the country. HRSA has invested in some of it. But there's much more that I think could build a seamless, coordinated healthcare delivery for that population that would then reside more robustly on health and healthcare providers that might reside 1,000 miles away or 500 miles away from that small community. The last point probably would be to build even stronger bridges between public health as it exists there and acute care and ambulatory care. It's an amazing thing to me that even in small towns you still see siloed focus on health, and it's not a natural fit. We're really trying to move on determinants of health using Life Course in our maternal child health program. That's a very public health orientation. It's not an orientation that's typically talked about inside acute care subspecialty hospital, for example. So increasingly, I think we will hopefully see this drive toward a better integration of primary care, again, in the context of public health. It's part of the reason why we're going back to the IOM and asking them to give us their best thinking, even as we push forward on this combined focus to HRSA.
Great. Okay, audience, get ready for your questions. I'm going to ask one more question, and then we're going to you. And the question is very simple, and if you could keep it as appropriately short as possible so we can get as many audience questions, if possible, that would be greatly appreciated. And the question is, with regard to the Affordable Care Act and its implementation from the perspective of your agency, what has changed thus far in your agency, and what is set to change?
I think the biggest change has been in response to the need for coordination and collaboration, true collaboration with the other agencies, and thinking through what are all the pieces that need to be mobilized and coordinated very, very carefully in order to be able to accomplish the goals that have been set out by the Act and folks that have been working on it. So I think that's the biggest change, although it's work that we were interested in and committed to before. There has been significant impetus for moving that forward, as you heard some of the examples that I gave and other things that have been mentioned by others. I think there has been an unprecedented coordination across the department as a result of that.
I would agree with that, certainly through our work trying to implement the quality provisions. I do want to acknowledge Q. Reed, who's been fantastic.
Oh, good.
Reminding us of opportunities and so forth. Not only at a leadership level, the Secretary Sebelius has set the stage for agency heads and so forth, which is very, very clear, but in addition to that, they stepped up both within and across operating components of HHS. People are talking and working together who hadn't before. So one of my colleagues is working with the folks at CMS, and one of them said, you know, I talked to so-and-so in this division, and I never talked to those guys before. And, well, good thing to get started now. I think we'll see more and more of them.
I just want to reaffirm that the boundaries have become, I think, very porous across the agency, and where we get a little bit of, there's still a bit of a wall there, the Secretary's expectation is very much to chip away at it and do it fast. And that's very helpful, but I think also the leadership across all of the operating divisions have rapidly developed very good working relationships. That helps as well. And as a matter of fact, the innovation website that Dr. Clancy mentioned just a bit ago, we came to her probably a month ago and said, the Healthy Way Initiative that I mentioned in my comments to you just a few minutes ago, could we please land the models on that website? We can go about taking taxpayer dollars to create a new one, but we don't want to do that. There's already an excellent innovation website, and now it's going to have more of a community focus to it, courtesy of this new initiative. So it's a concrete example of what that interaction across the agencies now looks like.
Yeah, I told you it was the A-team. All right, so over to this line here. Fire away.
It is the A-team, and I want to thank all of you for taking all of the time, not only your time, but your staff time to help us move issues forward. I'm Andrew Denton, and I work at Prevent Blindness America. And I want to thank Dr. Wakefield for the great expansion of the community health centers that we've just experienced to vision and eye health issues. Very, very important thing to our communities, and to all of those of you working in community health centers, please look to expand vision and eye health services. Same is true with the hard work we did around school-based health clinics, and also want to thank the Maternal and Child Health Bureau for your watch as expansion of the National Center for Children's Vision and Eye Health. And, you know, I say all that to say that, you know, as a patient advocacy organization, one of the things that's important to us is to understand how the relationship between the agencies comes back out of the community and to the patient level. The great work at the Centers for Disease Control and Vision Health Initiative is an example of that, and they recently talked about the importance of surveillance, which gets to Dr. Clancy. And, you know, we know that if we don't measure it, sometimes it doesn't happen. So in the case of vision and eye health, it means that the service delivery sometimes doesn't happen, and definitely the quality doesn't happen, and provision of resources towards it don't happen. So we have a great opportunity, as you move forward with CHIPRA, because it didn't happen in the first round, for us in the second round and third round, to make sure vision and eye health services are tied in and that we've been ensuring quality for it. But I wanted to give an example, because we just were talking about coordination and between and among your agencies. You know, so if we look at children's vision screening as an example, it happens either at the medical home or at a community-based center. Then there should be a referral. And then that referral needs to get linked to care. And then that link to care needs to go to the parent or the Head Start program or the school. And then it goes back to the medical home or the community-based place where it happened. Well, in each of those opportunities, we need to ensure that we have good data, that we're counting the same thing, that we're not counting apples and bricks, that we have performance measures to ensure that we're doing it, that our folks in the community health centers knows what's happening in the school-based health clinic, and that our educators know. I say that to say, perhaps you can talk more about how, in a real-life example like that, coordination is actually going to happen, and if you have plans to help us on the ground make that happen for our parents. Thanks so very much.
And given the time that we have, I'm going to ask one of you to answer that as briefly and succinctly as you can. Anybody want to volunteer?
Oh, can I give just one example? I mean, the other day, just because this totally warmed my heart. We didn't fund it, Robert Johnson did. So this young faculty member who's just finished being a clinical scholar is now on faculty, the son of migrant workers, has grew up in the San Joaquin Valley and, of course, has worked with all of the safety net clinics there. So he worked with them to develop a registry of patients with diabetes. Now, for him, this is a research project. For them, it is a way to track what's happening with their patients who understandably move around from one clinic to another. I think that's the kind of data sharing and shared responsibility and opportunity that the last Westerners has asked us about.
Thank you. Let's go to this line here.
Kay Randolph back from Michigan. I have a question for Dr. Wakefield. I think I heard you mention there would be an increase in residency slots, new residency slots for primary care. And I think at a meeting whose theme is social justice, when we reflect on the implications of that, we should step back and say that historically there's been a gap because the medical schools in the United States historically do not produce enough physicians to fill all the existing residency slots, leaving aside adding new ones. And that gap is filled often by people of color, often from India, where physicians are trained and come to the United States, not serving the people in India who are poor and very much in need. Meanwhile, we can see in our own workforce of physicians that is disproportionately white. And if we look to medical school admission practices, we can see that with some very bright and exciting exceptions, there is not a clear commitment to first changing the composition of the student bodies better to reflect the diversity and the changing demographics of the country, but secondly, to change the composition so that enough people of color are coming out of those institutions to change the composition of the entire workforce, because you would have to have a disproportionate production in order to change the whole workforce. And within that large body of people of color who aren't getting admitted to these schools, especially I would point out the condition of black men whose status in the society is threatened. So when I hear you say, add to the residency slots for primary care, I am prompted to ask about the policy that all the federal bureaucrats commanding billions of dollars that flow into academic and healthcare institutions whose policies do not promote diversity. What is the policy that you are going to implement under the new law to change the composition of our workforce to create social justice on racial and ethnic lines?
Obviously, your colleagues agree with you, it is such an important area to focus on. First of all, let me say, I don't think that the federal government solo is going to be provide a solution in its entirety to this particular challenge. We really have to do a better job of working with stakeholder organizations that share this agenda and that are very committed to the mission that you just so helpfully described. The challenge that we have is a shared challenge. I don't think the federal government by itself, certainly HRSA by itself, is going to solve that very thorny and complex set of issues that you just described. So I say that's a challenge for all of us collectively, including those of us in HHS and not even just inside of HRSA. Having said that, I would say that we have a number of programs that we're looking at very closely now that are really designed to strengthen the representation of disadvantaged students, which could be minority students, economically disadvantaged students, across our healthcare programs. We have a range of healthcare workforce programs and a number of them that are explicitly designed to target an increase in minority faculty, an increase in minority students coming in. We have centers of excellence that focus on Hispanic populations, that focus on African American populations. We have tools that are already in place. What we don't have is really an investment in an evaluation of what we have historically been getting through those various programs. So one of our high priorities over about the last 6 months has been focused on beginning to develop an evaluation around what we are achieving through those programs and what we're not achieving and what we need to make changes in them to better meet the demands and fill the gaps that you just described. So do we have tools that are at our ready? Yes, we do. How effective are they? With some of them, I can tell you. It's the reason why we got to this in that evaluation, because we have plenty of levers to pull. Some folks could argue whether or not the financial investment has been great enough, but my biggest concern is what are we getting for the investment we're making in those programs right now? So is it a high priority for us? You bet it is. Can we do it alone? No, we can't. Do we have some tools at the ready? Yes, we do. And hopefully within about a year, we'll have a better sense of what we're getting through those programs. But we also welcome any organization or individual's ideas about how we can move that agenda better. One big issue for us is supply of healthcare providers, but it isn't just supply, it's distribution and a reflection of culturally competent providers that reflects the population in this country. We agree with you wholeheartedly. That's not something that we would walk away from as a challenge. We share that challenge and recognize that.
Okay, we've snuck up on the end of the session, but we're not going to stop. But for those of you who have to get somewhere else, including our speakers, if any of you have to go, hopefully you don't, because we have several other questioners in the line we'd like to get to you, so we're going to continue. And I hope that doesn't offend anybody. We're going to go to this line over here.
We know that health reform implementation is going to be a local issue. It's going to be about communities work with the established kind to really see that what needs to happen. I am from the nonprofit, small community-based organization, nonprofit community that work a lot at the grassroots level with coalitions and organizing communities. And one of the questions that I want to ask is how is the various bureaus and departments supporting development of community capacity at the grassroots level? All of the information that is out, that is around the health reform, and all of the things that we need to get down to the grassroots level, it's not going to happen just by putting out publications and putting out news media. There has to be active outreach and active engagement. I'm hearing a lot of the terms evidence-based, and a lot of the money is focused towards evidence-based where the data is there. Over the years,
I'm going to have to ask you to get to your question.
Other issues, HIV prevention is a perfect one, but we're not there yet. mentioned is going to be key as well.
I would just add, you know, we've supported a couple of dozen communities. Now, support in this case is a very loose term, because we're actually trying to learn from them. So our contribution is supporting a learning network so they can learn from each other and with us about how to advance solutions in healthcare in their communities. This is all based on the premise at the end of the day, all health and healthcare, like hospitals, is open. And what's going to be very effective in Minnesota probably isn't the right fit for Devil's Lake, North Dakota, for Wellesley, Massachusetts, or, you know, filling in the blank. I would agree with everything you said about evidence-based. It's all about replicability. But I think moving forward, the fantastic opportunity we have, what we're going to have to be doing is learning and developing that evidence as we go. So just to give you an example, so what I get the most emails about is accountable care organizations. They don't even exist. They're a fantastic policy idea, and people are so excited they can barely contain themselves. But the good news about accountable care organizations and about shorter-term initiatives, such as effectively dinging hospitals if they have too many avoidable readmissions and so forth, is that ultimately they've got to look out beyond their walls. No more million out of the front door, we're done now. Now they've got to have an investment in the community. They haven't done this. The tax incentives from giving back to the community and so forth that some of you know about, my colleagues at CDC are very excited about, will be another way. So I think there will be resources. I don't think it's going to be a clean, easy path, but we've got to get there. And I think collectively we've also got to identify the communities that have the least capacity, that never get grants from us, that don't get state resources and support and so forth, because you can be sure that that's where we're going to find the most vulnerable.
And I'm hoping the panel is willing to stay for maybe two more questions.
Sure.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so we'll go over to this line here. Or wait, no, I'm sorry. Yeah, you're right, over there.
Okay, so this is a simple question, I think. How can we, as members of the public health workforce, help you three to influence the other high-level bureaucrats in other sectors to implement healthy public policy? Do you get the question?
You heard the question.
I mean, I know you're having those dialogues now, partly because of this act. And my question is, you alone can't get them moving necessarily. So how can we, in the public health sector, move those other governmental sectors into healthy public policy?
Who are those other governmental sectors you're referencing?
Like transportation and agriculture.
Okay, I thought you were talking about Congress.
I'm not answering your question. I thought you got like the high-level bureaucrats in those other departments.
Sure. Well, I'll just make a couple of comments. One, we're actually working pretty closely, not just with NHHS and across HHS, but also with some of our counterparts now and some of the other capital agencies. So we have an activity underway with HUD, with USDA, some with transportation, a lot with the Department of Education around anti-bullying efforts, for example. So it's, I think, a lot to expect of federal agents, of communities, if they don't see operationalized at the federal level, what they are expected to operationalize at the local level, which is, you know, full engagement of different community stakeholders. And so we're trying to do a little bit of practicing what we preach at the federal level too, and looking for those points of alignment where we've got a shared agenda. We're working with the Department of Labor, for example, right now on community health workers, trying to get a better understanding of what our investments are to couple with theirs. Part of this requires individuals and organizations to make new inroads. So where HHS might have been the place where you would typically think about going to, that's not your oyster really anymore, I don't think. Your oyster are the relevant programs within the various cabinet agencies. That's a big agenda. It's tough enough just to find your way through a large organization like the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. But there are major programs that you can find seeded through many of the other cabinet-level agencies. Don't ever hesitate to ask us where we are working that it might be of interest to you. And likewise, please always tell us if you see a national alignment with another part of the U.S. government saying the same thing, one of our agents, our operating division for the HHS, should be aligned with. We would want to know that too. So those would be my couple of comments on that. Maybe colleagues have a word.
I would just say it's a fantastic question. And the best questions, as you said, are simple, quote unquote. What I would suggest, though, that APHA could be doing right now, because those connections are going to need to be happening at the state level. No matter how you cut it, the Affordable Care Act is a state-based bill. So that means everything from very strong states in terms of public health, like New York, California,
thank you,
and so forth, to states that don't have the same kind of capacity. I won't name names here. And it does seem to me that through the chapter structure and so forth that you have, that there could be a whole lot of learning. Because mm-hmm. It seems to me at the end of the day, how to get there is going to have two main components. One is the ability to have some kind of hook, like we need a health impact on any time we're going to have a new policy, in the same way that we have to have environmental impact statements or something along those lines. And there are folks who are working on the details of that. But the other part, quite honestly, is that people know each other. People can't possibly work together and collaborate if they don't know who each other is. And so I can promise you that from HHS, you'll have a very strong partner, because we're acutely attentive to the fact that so many governors just turned over this week and are ready to hit the ground running to make all of our resources available to states and so forth.
Okay, last question.
Thank you, the A-team, and Dr. Clancy, what you just said about people knowing one another, I agree. And I'm glad to be here. I'm a Bruce Bray, Jackson, from Jackson, Mississippi. And as I said earlier this morning, Mississippi is the worst state in the union, and the part, specific part of Mississippi is the Delta part of Mississippi. And as I can't recall your name on the end, as I was reading your bio, the rural areas, how you approach that is different from how you approach the urban area. That being said, you want a model, you want a role model, the lady that she's here, you hear about a black man, whatever. Usually, I'm worried about her. That's my wife, and she's worried about her. I just recently went back to school and getting a doctor's in policy, in medical and policy and management. And I'm amazed to know that the new definition of health includes social health, economic health, personal health, psychological health, all of it. And that's my question, the psychology. I understand that someone just mentioned about this funding that's coming out, and the deadline is December 1st of this year, and you need to be a member of an organization, be a member of the government. What about a private person? Can a private person get this funding? And I'm really asking for myself. And the second thing I want to ask is, I heard you mention a website. Could you state specifically what it is for my wife to write it down, and then I will
I'm going to take the moderator's prerogative and ask you to come up and speak to the panel after we close, because those are very specific questions. I'm going to close this session out, and I apologize to my colleagues that are in line. There's still an opportunity to come up and ask directly of the panelists. I want to give a deeply felt appreciation for the A-team. Leadership matters in this work, and I think you'll all agree that we have excellent leadership at our key health agencies, and we look forward to supporting them as well as asking them to look for opportunities to work with us. So that concludes our session for today. Keep in mind that the APHA will be convening a series of these conversations to keep this issue alive and relevant to the practice of the 21st century public health. Thank you very much.